Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sociology. This is your hostess, Annie Sipukaya. Today we are talking to the authors of The Enigmatic Academy, Class, Bureaucracy, and Religion in American Education. One of the authors is Kristen J. Churchill. He is a professor of sociology at St. Thomas Aquinas College, author of numerous articles in sociology, and a licensed psychoanalyst in private practice in Manhattan. Gerald E. Levy is a sociologist and the author of Ghetto School, Class Warfare in an Elementary School. He taught at the college level for 40 years and is now retired. This book takes a comprehensive and critical look at the American educational system by using three different case studies: an upper-class liberal arts college in New England, an elite prep school for kids of wealthy parents who have deviated from upper-class norms, and an educational center for the American working class. The Enigmatic Academy points out the paradox between the bureaucratization of educational institutions and the liberal free-thinking values that they claim to hold. Kristen, let's start with you. What is the paradox in the American educational system?
Such as we've described it, points students toward a critical perspective on mainstream institutions while simultaneously preparing them to participate in those institutions and, in fact, to perpetuate the agendas that they find within those institutions. That's really a lot of the paradox that we're after here. And so if somebody is thinking about personal success, our book is not necessarily about how education steers them away from that necessarily, though the Job Corps case study may be an exception in that sense. But rather, the success at issue here is success of one's personal ideological commitment and how tenable that becomes once you enter the institutional training of these various institutions and then encounter the expectations of employers thereafter.
So it's not so much that institutionalized education doesn't prepare you for jobs in the workplace. It does, but it doesn't quite offer the liberal or critical mindset that they advertise.
Yes, and Jerry, maybe you want to take this up too, but I think that's closer to what we're
Well, two things. First of all, that as we point out in the conclusion, even for the broad middle classes, success is problematical despite their good education because the jobs are so few. Mm-hmm. The second point I would like to make is that one of the reasons we wrote the book was to try to answer the question of why is it in the educational world all of these ideologies of progress are part and parcel of liberal arts education and other kinds of education, and why are things so bad? That is to say, why is the society in which we're living in its foreign and domestic policy seem to be the opposite of that, where in our educational institutions we are committed to values and training people to do things which they seem incapable of doing once they get into the system. So there must be something in the educational world which prepares people both, which caters to and supports their idealistic, liberal, sometimes radical, progressive inclinations, at the same time prepares them to enter the bureaucratic world where they become the supporters of the very policies which in their educational lives and in their idealistic lives they opposed. That presented a problem to us, which we wanted to solve by actually describing in a number of ways what educational institutions actually do.
Right. So you guys did a case study with three separate schools, and could you describe these three schools and the differences between them? Because you looked at different kinds of schools, different ages as well.
Yeah, they are rather distinct, and which is what attracted us to them as case studies. Jerry, would you like to answer this, or would you like me to field it?
Oh, I think you can take a crack at that, CJ.
Okay. sure, yeah, and feel free to cut in as I answer the question. So there are three case studies in the book. In brief, one is an alternative liberal arts college, very small liberal arts college in the Northeast. The second school is which we call Mountain View School, is a very small boarding school for more or less upper-class boys who've been expelled from prestigious prep schools, often boarding schools. And then the third case study is the United States Job Corps Center, which provides job training to youth who are from either rural or inner city areas and haven't completed high school, may have some ambitions for college, but really are being channeled toward trade union jobs. At least that's the history of the Job Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what actually brought us to write about each of these places is a little bit, it's very specific. In other words, the first college we both had, the first school, Pluford College, we have very deep ties to each of us and have experienced it from the positions of student and professor. In fact, that's how we got to know each other in the first place. And we figured that when we first started working on this book, that it was Pluford was a really nice example of how education for the new middle classes, that is the staff, the people who will become the staff of bureaucracies and corporations and the arts and the military, as distinct from the old middle class of more independent professionals, that Pluford was a good case study of how people get prepared for these new middle class professions while at the same time being rigorously prepared in the curriculum of the school to critique those things. We had an immense amount of data at our research at our fingertips from all of our experience. And after writing up that first case study and publishing it as an article, we realized that we had the beginnings of a book on our hands. But the problem, of course, was how do you get that depth of ethnographic material for representative case studies of lower and upper class education? In other words, to fill in the three levels that we were after.
Right.
And so as these things happen to ethnographers, by chance, I was hired to be a housemaster and an English teacher at Mountain View School. And it quickly became apparent to me that to both Jerry and me, because we were meeting, visiting all while I was working at this school for 2 years, that it was a good bookend to Pluford in that the kids who were brought to Mountain View are effectively the school is trying to rescue them from having fallen out of grace with the upper class in a number of ways and give them a way to return to that class, albeit through an alternative route and maybe with an alternative future ahead of them within that upper class milieu. And then so both of these first two case studies, Pluford and Mountain View, came to us by way of lived experience converted into research. The third case study, the Job Corps, we had to go after in a sort of more constructed, organized way. And in a nutshell, it took us about a year and a half of contacting people at the Department of Labor to finally be allowed to spend a year doing field work at this Job Corps Center. which we approached as more typical participant observers of coming from the outside, entering the inside of the culture, and then spending lots and lots of time just in living through the experience of the campus of the Job Corps Center, talking to people, eating with them, interviewing them, attending events with them, all that kind of stuff. And that then became our third case study. And so each of these case studies has a different origin, but they all fit into this project of describing the pursuit of what we call secular redemption in each of these social class levels, schools that service each of these social class levels.
Yeah, you do mention that term secular redemption quite often in the book. What exactly do you mean by that?
Jerry? Well, I think what we mean is that people who find themselves in different places in society may or may not be formally religious. And if they are formally religious, their lifestyle, and sincerely religious, they are attempting to be true to certain values which are part of the world great religions. But people who are formally religious may have values of a secular nature that are just as important as their religious values. For example, and may need to feel redeemed from a world which has been problematic or disfavored them. So, for example, the young people in the Job Corps, for them, the training that will lead them to a job redeems them from perhaps the sin of lower class life. The middle class students at Plewfort often come from backgrounds where they are alienated from society, and the curricula which they study at the society, everything from feminism to multiculturalism to sometimes radical political ideologies, it can be as varied as the curriculum. Their attachment to those ideologies which are driving the curriculum and their attachment to the process, the community life in Plewfort, which promises them that this will be an important event in your life, not just in terms of the result, but in terms of the process, living in the community, participating in the democracy of the community, having a close relationship with a mentor. All of that points towards a redemption from problematics in their life, which they may attach to their education, although they may not call it secular redemption. You see what I mean?
They almost never do call it that. they would withdraw from the label, I think. But it's our contention, as Jerry is really clearly describing, to try to explain how it is in fact a quest for redemption.
Interesting. So in a way, education, or what most people look for in terms of, especially with college and with liberal arts, is this kind of, well, I guess there's this image of when you go off to college, you're going to somehow change the world, or there's this, well, illusion, I think you even call it an illusion, of making the world better. But you say that all three of these schools actually end up perpetuating the status quo. How does that happen? Jerry?
Well, it happens because it happens differently for people from different social classes. If you are a idealistic, ideologically driven, redemptively driven student, mm-hmm. and you believe that through environmental studies you're going to save the world by engaging in environmentally redemptive activities, and you're $50,000 in debt at the end of your education, and you try and get a job working in the environmental field, and you think, well, you might be able to get something for $20,000 or $25,000 a year. Or if you're an architect who believes that urban planning will save the inner cities, and then you go and work for an architectural firm which is bent on making money and building skyscrapers, and you discover that in your work you can only engage in a kind of almost very organized part of the architectural process over which you have no control. So the alienation which comes from occupational work, where most of the jobs in government, in the military, in the corporate world, even in the arts, are attempts to make money, and maybe in tension with the idealistic notions that people have. So while they are prepared to engage in world-changing, personally redemptive activities, they often find that their ability to do things is very limited. Take our president, Obama, and the problematics between his idealistic speeches and what he's able to accomplish. To a certain extent, as a national security bureaucrat, who in order to be elected president in the first place had to be acceptable to an establishment which then would allow him to be a serious candidate. Well, I think Obama's problem is really the problem of everyone, particularly those people who are most idealistic and may be critical of the society and want to change it. So what we discovered in our odyssey through these schools and other schools too is that there's a kind of double education going on. There's a support of the idealistic intentions of people to change themselves, and through changing themselves, change the world. And then there's the way in which they relate to the bureaucratic process within these schools and the demands of organizations, all of which have agendas that come from the top, which are often in tension with the very things that the students who are aspiring lawyers, doctors, politicians, artists want to change. Mm-hmm. And so we try and describe that process in all of its complexities in these three schools.
Now, in the school where the kids are still in high school, which I believe is Mountain View, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Where they're in prep school. You said that they're trying to kind of mold them back into being the upper-class students that they think they should be, but they've actually been rejected, or they've been on the fringes of that kind of upper-class society. Do you mean in terms of youth that is just like delinquency, or is it just a matter of not fitting into upper class life?
Well, in Mountain View, there's a range of ways in which these students have not fit in to the upper class scenarios that they find at these prep schools and boarding schools, and I think in a kind of summary statement about them, one could say that what they are effectively rejecting in their behavior, and by behavior I mean perhaps drug use, refusal to obey rules in school, alternative styles of dress and behavior in the classroom and amongst their peers. What they're doing in this is, in one way or another, visibly rejecting the ethos of the privilege which is justified through claiming that one has earned it by working very hard at these schools. That's a lot of what these young men reject. And what I'm thinking about specifically is Seamus Raman Khan's book, Privilege, in which he describes at a very elite prep school in New Hampshire how the students who are at that school often see their situation and the advantages that attach to it. They see it as something which they have, in fact, in one way or another, earned by way of their very diligent work within the curriculum of that school. And they're trained by the school in a certain sense not to really look very much at the privileged situation that they're born into and the connections that lead them into this place that lets them have a position at a school like that and then all the future advantages that it brings to it. These boys at Mountain View School, you could say that even though they wouldn't articulate it in this sense, that they're rejecting that ethos in one way or another. And the class from which they emerge doesn't want to accept their rejection. And so there's a range of schools that they encounter before Mountain View, more therapeutically calibrated schools, schools that are designed to have very sort of rigorous sort of re-education programs to socialize these boys back into the places where they came from. The boys who end up at Mountain View School have often been through a few of those places, and none of the re-education has worked. And so their parents often come to Mountain View, at least at the time of this research, saying that we've tried everything, and now we need you to achieve the fix that has not worked elsewhere. And what we had determined by way of the research that they're really asking of Mountain View is to cultivate these boys' deviance into something which is tolerable and also useful to the class from which they emerged.
Would you say as well that perhaps these boys are actually more aware of the privilege that they come from and are more bothered by it?
I would say that they are tremendously bothered by it. That they and one of the reasons they're bothered by it is because it has been so easy for them in some ways. They know they'll never lack for money, but they are expected to be successful. Their parents have been inordinately successful. So the anxiety of approaching a situation in which your parents are, very successful business people or successful in government or highly placed in the liberal professions can be very anxiety provoking, and they rebel against it by rejecting the self-discipline, gentility, ability to present yourself in a socially acceptable manner, ability to perform, by doing the exact opposite as often students in other social classes do in their youth culture. That is to say, they cultivate styles of activity which are exactly opposite of what is expected as a successful adult. But these students do it so much and so intensely that they are kicked out of the prep schools that they are in. And then one thing that C.J. didn't mention, the school for many years was run by a very, very successful upper-class educator. You would call him a Boston Brahmin. And he has the both the understanding and empathy with the boys and the ability to communicate to them how they might possibly return to the fold by exhibiting a modicum of gentility in the right places, but will still be able to practice their deviant behavior elsewhere as long as it doesn't interfere with the work they're going to do. So that the educational process of return is very complex. See what I mean?
Yeah, so they're trying to kind of channel that kind of rebellion into perhaps something more creative, something more acceptable.
Yeah,
something more creative, something more acceptable. And I would add to this, I'm glad that Jerry brought up the Boston Brahmin, who we call Rod Bales in this case study, that in this case, as opposed to the Plewfort College case, in the case of Mountain View School, it is perhaps more the school that is on the redemptive mission than the students. That is, the school is trying to redeem these boys to bring them back into the fold and to show them that it is possible to be deviant, but tempered in such a way that it is still acceptable. And let me just give one little illustration from my own experience, and this is mentioned in a footnote in the book. When I interviewed at the school, I was it was a full day interview, and I went over to Rod's house in the evening for a cocktail, and we were sitting there chatting, and I told him I wanted to be fully upfront about this. I told him that I was gay, and he was fully accepting, no problem, and said, "I'm very glad that you told me this." Then he said, "You can never let anyone know. And if you do disclose it, I'll deny that I knew anything." And
wow.
I think that, now it's a whole separate issue as to why I in my early 20s would be willing to go through that. But part of it is I wanted the research. And I also thought the school was very interesting. But he was effectively telling me that what he would see as my deviance, that would have been his perception of it, I think. Mm-hmm. What he saw as my deviance was not a problem, but also had to be managed in such a way that it didn't become a problem for the institution's agenda.
And it had to be it had to be segmented from his occupational life.
Right.
In the same way that the upper class boy deviants are asked to segment their deviance, their drug taking, their drinking alcohol, their what some would call vulgar behavior from what is sociably acceptable in occupationally successful society.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, as a staff member, he was asked to do what we all have to do in a way, to segment our deviant and perhaps more idealistic lives from life in the bureaucracy, which controls to a certain extent the vast majority of the work that takes place in this society.
Right. So it's kind of like you're allowed to have these things that are considered to be unacceptable, but you're not allowed to talk about them.
When I was a psychodrama intern at St. Elizabeth's Hospital many, many years ago, the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening. I happened to be a student activist at the time, and I was resolved to, for a variety of reasons, demonstrate at the White House over the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was in 1963. My supervisor found out about it, and he said, "Well, you're a government employee. I'm not going to criticize you for having your radical values, but if you make them public, you'll be fired."
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the same. It's a very graphic way in which all of us, to a certain extent, have to make certain compromises in our deepest values. And we're not asked. They don't say, "Well, you can have any politics you want, just don't let it enter into your public life in the occupational bureaucratic world."
Yeah.
And all of us are taught how to make those distinctions. The problem with these upper class boys is that they refuse to do that on principle. And mm-hmm. so the task of the school was to find a person who identified with them enough and understood them well enough to guide them back. and convince them that, well, it might not be such a bad idea for you to go back to prep school or go to some college.
Right. That's quite an interesting thing that the bureaucracy asks for, though, because it's kind of the culmination of the industrial age of where, you know, your personal life and your work life are completely separate, as almost as if you were two separate people.
And that's one of the classic assumptions of one of the great sociologists who influenced our work. Max Weber, in his classic essay on bureaucracy, makes that point again, that bureaucracy is the separation of one's personal life from one's occupational life, so that the bureaucracy can actually create and sustain a predictable policy in which bureaucrats can be counted upon to fulfill the agenda of the people who control the bureaucracy.
Right, and these schools are effectively training grounds for how to achieve the split, how to manage that split within the self that, as Jerry Sangweber describes, and part of how they do it, I think, is, you know, one could refer to Weber's other great essay, "Religious Rejections of the World and Their Directions," in that these schools train these students to cultivate their what we call secularly religious rejections of the world and maintain them with great vigor, and have them be a source of an ongoing sense of redemption, even as these students go on to accommodate themselves to the agendas of bureaucracies with which they are quite opposed at some internal ideological level.
So in a way, it kind of teaches them just how to survive in a world of bureaucracy, basically.
Yeah,
and I think we could further state that is a way then in which, if you accept the assumption which the mainstream press is talking about all the time, that the vast majority of money, resources, is going to the top and has been consistently since at least the late 70s, probably earlier, that then bureaucracy becomes not only a way of controlling individuals, but controlling individuals in such a way, and we say this in our conclusion, that it is the middle classes in their positions as managers, professional bureaucrats, at all levels of the bureaucracy, some well-paid, some not so well-paid, which support a process which eventually supports the dominance of the upper classes. So if you were to ask today, well, which everybody is agreeing upon now, no matter what your ideological position, that the vast amount of wealth seems to be concentrated at the top, how is this achieved organizationally, and what role does education at all levels play in this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I just
that's the larger question that we attempt to address in our study. It's not just that people are trapped in their positions and have to segment their occupation lives from their personal lives. It's that the process through which this is done feeds a larger process in which the upper classes sustain their wealth and power, and the middle classes, by and large, assist the upper classes in doing this through their occupational roles and their roles as bureaucrats. And the lower classes, who we haven't discussed very much yet, how do they come to accept their role? And we try and at least raise those issues in our last essay.
Yeah, but I would like to, before we get on to that last essay, I'd like to just say something about what you've been describing, Jerry, because I think this is a really vital element in the book as a whole, that is how the middle classes are made use of by the upper classes and the larger power structure. And to point to specific ethnographic details, in the Mountain View case study, we spend a good amount of time describing how Rod Bales, who's from the Boston upper class going well in, back into the 19th century, very old money, how he manages to make peace with the middle class faculty who he must recruit if the school is to function as a school on the terms of the state in which it exists. I mean, the actual state in the United States in which it exists, dealing with their educational bureaucracy. He needs these middle class people to join in his project. And so they are tolerated and made use of while also being kept at a certain kind of distance. Now, that's Mountain View. In the Job Corps, the staff and faculty at that place are filled with middle-class professionals who believe deeply in rescuing these kids from poverty. And most of them give every ounce of energy they have to making it work. But the system in which they do it is calibrated, it seems, to preventing that final success from happening. And so as long as a place like the Job Corps can make use of these middle-class professionals, it can go on doing what its ultimate agenda may be, while maintaining the kind of patina of salvation for the lower classes that it presents as its front, as its stated purpose.
Mm-hmm. And so how do the lower classes feed into this cycle? We talked about how the middle class kind of almost accepts the bureaucratization, or perhaps isn't aware of it. I think most people don't really think about how, even if we say, oh, there's so much inequality and the rich are getting richer and so forth, really on an individual level, we just think, okay, well, how can I, get a better job or a better position? How do the lower classes deal with that?
Right. Well, Jerry, maybe you want to speak to this in a moment, but let me just say something right at the outset, which is that those middle classes, I'm not sure if it's necessarily that they don't know the bind that they're in, but their own private agendas of what they want in their personal lives may rise above whatever their critical perspective is on the bureaucracy. In the case of the lower class students at the Job Corps, this is very interesting, I think. They are vividly aware of what seems to be going on in this place and have developed a very sophisticated critical analysis of it, maybe not spoken in academic terms such as we might, but in just the way they describe their everyday lives at the Job Corps, they have a sense that they're being used. And mm-hmm. they can point to evidence to make the case. And as any reader of our book will see, and we fill that Job Corps case study with the perspectives of these young people as they strive for something better and find themselves sort of hitting up against a rigged situation which doesn't seem to want to let them get much success at all. And so what they say over and over to us is, this place is like a prison. Now, many students might say that about schools, and one might just dismiss it as, oh, that's just kids speaking. But these students mean it in a different way. And they know that the corporations that the government hires to run Job Corps centers are also often making a lot of their money in running private prisons. And the way in which the Job Corps, as we encountered it, was organized resembled nothing other than a prison in many ways. Lacking all of the more comfortable qualities that Mountain View and Plewfort College have within their confines. All the while, if you look at it on the basis of per capita spending, the government is spending, according to one study that we found in the research, spending the equivalent per kid at the Job Corps of what it would cost to send somebody to Harvard for a year.
Mm-hmm. And furthermore, the vast majority of people who go to the Job Corps come from poverty cultures where there's the schools to a great extent have been abandoned. The infrastructure is broken down. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of drugs. There's a lot of violence. This has been described over and over again, ethnographically and otherwise, and by journalists. They come to the Job Corps recruited by people who are promising them that, oh, it's going to be like a college. And when they get there, in innumerable ways, they discover that it's very much like the milieus in which they've learned to survive in. A certain amount of the students actually feel it's better and identify with the program, but many don't. But here's the rub. To the extent that the program is successful, these people are being trained mostly for jobs in the service sector that are minimum wage or a little better, and if you count up what they're going to make, it's often at the poverty level or just a little better. So the promise of a job is not a job that's going to pay them a kind of middle-class wage where they can afford maybe an apartment or the version of the American dream, which is different from all other social classes. They are being trained for jobs that are slightly better than unemployment. And many of these people actually prefer going into less legal occupations because they can make more money and actually have more status doing things which are illegal. And so these students are asked to give up their lower class youth culture so that they might learn to be, Americans, middle class citizens. And they discover the hypocrisy in that. And so many return to the streets from which they've come, the gangs from which they've come. Many of them end up in prison. Some of them end up in mental hospitals. Some of them may improve their life. But when we tried to get statistics from the Department of Labor as to basically the economic structure of the Job Corps and what was the relationship of profit to infrastructure, to the money that was paid students, how they were relieved of that money through infractions, the jobs they get, we were not able to, they wouldn't give us the information. And finally, we went on the what is it called, CJ? When you want to get information from the government that you're entitled to.
Oh yeah, yeah, freedom of information.
They wanted us to pay a huge sum of money. So basically, they didn't want us to give us the information, so that we might find out in greater depth the economic structure and consequences of what this training meant. What we saw was a situation in which most of the classes, very little education was going on, where 500 young people were concentrated into a very, very small space with, a social ecology which probably is worse than some of the better equipped prisons.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting. It reminds me of this idea that we have of recently arrived immigrants to the United States, that they do jobs that most people in the middle and upper classes, you know, wouldn't be caught dead doing. And it seems like this Job Corps Center also kind of teaches the lower classes to do exactly those jobs that need to be done or else society would fall apart, but that other people don't want to do. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it's more than fair. And I think we would further say that through this education and through their life in other lower class milieus, the larger society communicates to these youth what they can expect out of life. And so what options do they have? Well, some of them, through a sheer act of will, kind of somehow get out of that way of life. And a fair amount go to college and get jobs into the middle class. To the extent that these jobs are available, they seem to be getting less and less available, not only for the lower classes, the aspiring lower classes, but the middle classes. A fair number of these students give up and return to milieus that they are familiar with, and the youth culture, which is the exact opposite of what the Job Corps claims to want them to rid themselves in, and in a very tragic way, as we see in so many lower class milieus, these youth turn on each other.
Mm-hmm. Christian, how would you say that this relates to the issue of people voting against their own interests? Because we do hear that a lot, and this myth of American meritocracy that as long as you work hard, you will make it, and using exceptions to kind of romanticize that entire view, like saying, oh, well, Oprah made it, so can you, which are messages that the media definitely feeds us on a daily basis. How does that relate to voting, you think?
To relate to people voting against their own interests?
Yes.
Well, I guess you could say, if we're stepping back and looking at the book as a whole, that you know, and I guess especially in the Plufort case study, that people are, by way of these educational institutions, they're encouraged to believe that the system contains within itself the means of its own correction, the way for it to, you know, it contains the capacity to make itself better. Now, if that's what you're taught, and you're made to believe it through a near religious form of indoctrination, you'll hold on to that view. And so let me just give a couple of quick examples from the case studies. In the Plufort case study, one of the defining qualities of this college is its commitment to participatory democracy. And so within the college structure, students, staff, and faculty all participate in monthly democratic, they get together and they decide on bylaws and debate issues on campus. And this is celebrated as the epitome of the American ideal of participatory democracy. So they, they go through this institution both being trained in the curriculum to be socially critical, but also being imbued with a sense that at base, democracy such as we find it in the United States has within it the seeds of its own salvation. In the case of the Job Corps, the faculty and staff engaged in a kind of language that was more explicitly religious in its tones than we found in either of the other two institutions. A kind of evangelistic preaching to the students in secular terms that if they just maintain their faith in the process and endured the often quite punitive sanctions against minor infractions that that process put upon them, that this would then be the path to salvation. You know, one thinks of the religious supplicant sort of with a whip to his or her back making it through. And so in that case, the person is again saying that as long as you have enough faith in the system, it will change itself. And what we're really saying in this book is that the system contains within itself its own the motives of its own agendas, which it does not want to change. And so if people are voting against their interests, in summary, it's because they're taught to. And maybe also because it's just too difficult to face the fact sometimes that that this is what you're being asked to do. And so one finds various ways to avoid that truth.
Do you see any hope, Jerry, for getting out of this paradox?
Yes. If you read the quote by Hannah Arendt, which we quote two of her pithy paragraphs from the preface to The Origins of Totalitarianism, we say, in a sense, if I can paraphrase what she's saying, that gloom and doom and illusory optimism are both ways to avoid responsibility, and that the goal, the purpose of the intellectual sociologist, whatever you want to call, is to comprehend, is to understand, and to describe them things as they are, relentlessly, and that is the beginning of resistance. The other thing I think we say in the book is that in these fine liberal arts schools where progressive ideologies of all sorts are supported, while students are being trained both to support their ideologies and enter the system, they have the existential choice of not entering the system. They have the existential choice of trying to be true to their ideals, whatever they may be. Of course, this can, being true to one's ideals, as we know, can always have a cost. One may not be able to make the money that one's hoped. You know, there's all sorts of sacrifices that people have to make if they're going to change the world. But I think ultimately, so that first of all, people at all levels have an existential choice, no matter what the options seem to be, and that secondly, I think I lost my train of thought. The other point I want to make is that these redemptive ideologies, as much as people may use them to cover the fact that they are co-opted, these ideas about how to change things have a value whether they are immediately applicable or not. And so that in a way, these redemptive ideologies and the tradition of passing them on is, in a certain way, the only hope for real change. And as long as those ideas are kept alive, there always is a hope that something may change, and that in our own way, we feel, and I think I can speak for CJ also, that in writing this book, we are not trying to say that it's all wrapped up, that nothing can change, but that really, if things are going to change, we have to address certain issues that it's very difficult to address, because in our society, most people believe if there's any hope, it's education. Mm-hmm. And we want to qualify that. But yes, in qualifying that and trying to be true to our own perceptions and our own analysis, we are not saying that nothing can be done. And I think if you read the conclusion carefully, particularly the last couple of paragraphs, you'll see that we are not gloom-doom pessimists. And that in itself, according to our own values would be irresponsible. And that's why we quote Hannah Arendt in those first two paragraphs.
Yeah, I want to second everything that Jerry just said, and you said it so well, Jerry, that I can't add much to it except just a couple of things. One is to reiterate, we believe very much in this idea that Arendt puts forward that, as Jerry said, gloom and doom and reckless optimism are two sides of the same problem, and that one has to be honest and, as she says, comprehend really what's going on as free of illusion as possible. And so, as Jerry also said, the ideologies, the educational ideologies and other ideologies in these institutions have much value in them. And this is part of why we selected the word enigmatic in the title of the book, because the very thing that causes the problem can also be the source of its solution. And I think that that's an important message for the reader to come away with from this book. And one more point that I think is very important that we make in the introduction is that Jerry and I are completely entwined in these institutions ourselves in various ways. We've done the exact opposite of rejecting them because we are educators, students. We believe very much in liberal arts education. And, you know, we've committed our lives to being active professionals within that that milieu. And if we thought it was all gloom and doom, we'd have gone elsewhere. So I think that's an important element to the study and that a reader would hopefully keep that in mind in reading what we've tried to present as honest and sometimes very difficult to hear analyses of what's going on the ground.
So if people are interested in buying your books, where can they go to do that?
Well, there's a couple of options. One is Temple University Press website has it would be easy enough to buy it through Temple University Press. And then Temple has its own webpage dedicated to Enigmatic Academy. Of course, Amazon.com is there as well. There's paperback as well as hardcover and Kindle versions of the book as well. So you could get it in any of those three formats.
Perfect. Gerald Levy, Kristen Churchill, thank you so much for being on today. It's a really interesting conversation.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Kristen J. Churchill and Gerald E. Levy, authors of The Enigmatic Academy, Class, Bureaucracy, and Religion in American Education. This is your host, Annie Sipulkaya. Thanks for listening to New Books in Sociology. See you next time.